water. En dat betekent het tweede uur van Zemayem van deze woensdagavond. En blijf ons ook checken, moet ik er even bij vertellen, op onze MySpace-site www.myspace.com/Mayem. Kun je morgen programma terugluisteren, playlist enzovoort enzovoort. En reageren kan altijd op info@mayem.nl. De tweede uur vanavond is helemaal gevuld met een interview wat ik een tijdje geleden had met Jackie Ham van Dial. Hun cd is er, hun nieuwe cd is er namelijk. En die heet 168K en verschijnt op hun eigen Seed Records label. Eind jaren 70 begon zij haar carrière toen in New York. Toen was ze lid van de No Wave dames formatie UT. Als eerste wilde ik wel eens weten hoe het sfeertje toen de tijd in New York was.
Oh my god, it was very, very fertile. Very intense, very exciting. It's very hard to explain it all. There was the East Village scene and Soho. And Soho, of course, is really a wasteland of old warehouses with artists. There had been the loft scene from the 50s and 60s and 70s, where a lot of the free jazz people played in lofts. So that there was that going on, and was still the tail end of that. And then there was CBGBs, which I guess television had talked Hilly into opening his bar on the Bowery to this new music that television was doing. And then Patti Smith, Talking Head, the Ramones, and Blondie were the first wave. And
but was New York in that time the inspiration to start it?
Myself and Sally Young of UT had grown up about an hour outside of New York and very under the influence of New York. We didn't really kind of make, we'd always decided in high school we were going to do a band in New York, so that was kind of a long plan. Nina had come from England, really attracted to the avant-garde art scene in New York, and she arrived, I guess, in the middle 70s and met Rhys Chatham. She started playing guitar with Rhys and some of his projects, and I met Nina. I was working at a restaurant, and I ran into Nina, and we became friends, and Sally then moved to New York, and I was already living in New York, and we really just got together and started playing, and the chemistry was immediate and fantastic, and so we formally started the end of 78. At that time, the No Wave scene with Mars, DNA, The Contortions, Teenage Jesus, the four famous ones, but also, I guess, Theoretical Girls, Glenn Branca, Jeffrey Lone's group, Boris Policeman. I was extremely into this guy who just was on stage with Police Radio, and really free association and all sorts of wonderful things that's extremely current now. And I guess there's just a hell of a lot going on between, there was only a few clubs, it was a very small scene, so there's Max's, CBGB's, the artist space in Soho and Franklin Furnace were places that put on, then Tier 3 opened, which is where we did our first gig, and we did our second gig at Max's. Maybe then the Mud Club opened soon after. So there was just this scene going on. But, I mean, essentially, Sally and me had grown up very into progressive music. We were very into, we were exposed to jazz and really free jazz when we were like 15, 16. And we were also very into Jimi Hendrix and Velvet Underground. So we had already kind of formulated our aesthetic that was very close to the No Wave thing before we even got exposed to what was actually going on. We were very into television. Little Johnny Jewel, the first single, where in fact he's talked about trying to do kind of free jazz with guitar, as Rudolph Gray was doing at the same time similarly. That was the kind of thing that we had grown up with, that merge. So that was natural for us. Nina came from England and Europe, and she was naturally just has a natural advanced aesthetic. She's not at all, doesn't at all have kind of the English or American, almost like blues, R&B, Celtic thing that, let's say, we were all influenced by. You couldn't help it if you grew up. Nina actually was born in South Africa for the first 6 years of her life, but then was in England, but always had, just has a very unique un-Western tonality that just naturally comes out of her. And so that was a factor in us. That's just a natural thing there. So our dissonance, so-called, because we were often accused, why you're so dissonant, that was natural to us. That's what we liked. That just came out of us.
But there's not much on albums that we still can get from Ut.
Everybody had the same problems with putting records out.
That was why you migrated to London.
That was one of the many reasons. I mean, it was essentially that New York City at that time, it was a ghetto. Very difficult to play outside of New York. Very difficult to get a record. There was Lust on Lust, which was Charles Ball. And he had put out Teenage Jesus. And we did a single with him that we recorded in February 1980. And we actually had the cover done and everything was done. But then he disappeared. And his label collapsed right when ours was supposed to come out. So that was very, very frustrating for us. Contacted the Fall because they were very much on our wavelength, and they said that we could play with them and gig with them if we got over to England. At the same time, John Loder of Southern Studios, we met him, and he said he would record us for free if we could get over there. So we did do some recording with him, but it did not turn out well, so we did not use anything, except for one track. But essentially, our first thing we put out was a live tape of a gig at the venue in November 81, and we put that on our own label out, and then we did an EP called Ut, which came out in 84, and then we did an album, Conviction, then the early live life, which was live things from 79 through 85.
And you got a lot of airplay through John Peel, of course.
Yes, I mean, early days, John Peel was a supporter. I mean, a person that was very instrumental in helping us was Scott Pearing, who has sadly died. He was on the road with the Fall when we originally contacted them, and he helped us. At the time, he worked at doing PR for Rough Trade, and he later became the main independent plugger. He really broke the underground. Everyone from New Order on, he got on the radio. He talked to everybody, the radio people, into playing, and not just Peel. Peel was obviously into everybody. I'm talking about everybody radical. But Scott was instrumental in getting just about everybody in the independent scene onto the radio and really broke it to the overground. So, but Scott helped us a great deal during that time, never kind of formally, but he was a very important person and a very wonderful person.
In 1988, In Guts House came out, and then 1989, Agrello, produced by Steve Albini, or he recorded
okay,
it.
Okay, but I mean, we should clarify. I mean, Albini didn't produce it. Albini really just engineered it. We were very much on the same wavelength, and this is one of the first records that he had engineered. He was a musician like us, and how he approached recording, which was to capture things very close to in the first couple of takes. His talent was knowing that when you record things, in order to get the sound for the mix, the sound you want, it's very, very important to record them properly, to record them as you want them. And so mics and positions of mics and amp sounds are critical. We didn't have to say much to him in terms of guitar sounds, because he knew. You know, we didn't have to. So that when people say, well, the sound of Griller is Albini's, well, it's not. I mean, the guitar sounds, that's our guitar sound. That's us. But there were other problems, because Griller was rushed. And that, to us, was a problem. Whereas in Guts House, we had a lot more time. And we were more in control.
Down.
shortly after that, you split up.
We all wanted to do our own thing, and it has to do with just the intensity of being in a band is like a marriage, is like a family. I think it was us wanting to go and do our own things. It wasn't a big conceptual breakup. It had run its course, but we could have continued. We were in many ways ahead of our time, and now I feel people's ears have become much more sophisticated, dealing with polyrhythm, dealing with cut-ups, just from Jungle on, how people, and electronica, and dance music, how people are cutting together different sounds. These were all things that, in New York, because, let's say, the merge between free jazz and rock and all kinds of music, in a way, we had that openness to the merge of sounds. And let's say society has now come up to it, and so that does not seem, it's just easier to appreciate now. And it's unfortunate that, yeah, that we broke up. Shortly after, Rob Smith actually is an artist and a musician. He was the guitar player in God. Ed Lucicatelli was the drummer of God at one point. Rob and me started playing in the 90s together and began Dial also with Lou on drums and Dom Weeks, who was in Furious Pig. Lou drummed with us for some time and then left, and Rob began doing these extraordinary experiments on drum machine. Not normal, not like just being a rhythm unit, but really as a sound unit, and did some incredible things. Dial has been the four of us and some other people at different times.
I wonder, was the feel much different from when you first started out in New York?
Well, I mean, in a way, the 90s were very difficult, because on one hand it should have been better, because obviously, as you know, the whole thing about Nirvana and punk finally breaking, I mean, that was Sonic Youth's movie or video or whatever it was, that title, Punk Finally Breaks in America in the 1990s. Essentially, when things become mainstream, you'd think that things get better, but in fact things get worse in a different way, because when everything's new, you may be outside, but there's more opportunities for kind of subversion and getting things around, because maybe there's nothing big in place. There's no, I'm not being completely articulate about this, but essentially once Nirvana happened and Sonic Youth were also on the big major label, and in a sense, once the kind of noise rock thing became standardized and became a big business, actually it was more difficult. It was very hard for Dial in the 90s in London to get gigs and just to operate. It was kind of ironic, but also not, if you understand how things work. When things become mainstream, that people have interest in money, and in fact, things, the radical things, are rejected more.
Yeah, no, but with your debut as a Dial, you returned to a much rawer sound than on the more produced last Ut album. Was that what you wanted?
The last Ut record, Griller, because we had a drummer, that changed how we were doing things, and changed, in one sense, that there is some kind of perception different with In Gott's House. But I wouldn't say that the aesthetic, the raw aesthetic, is very much there in Ut as it is in Dial. And certainly my slice of things has been consistent right on through. I mean, if you listen to my songs from Ut, you will not see that much difference to Dial. And I mean, the rawness in Dial, you know, we record primarily capturing the things live. We record ourselves playing in rehearsal or at gigs or wherever, but we record ourselves primarily not in the studio. It's not that we didn't want to go into the studio, but extraordinary things happen when you just capture yourself spontaneously. And also the way the compression of the analog cassette machine has a beautiful sound that we love. It's sort of perfect compression, which, you know, people go spend a long time in studios trying to recreate what, in fact, the analog cassette machine does quite brilliantly.
Both albums are very difficult to get over here. Is there no distribution in Europe?
I know. That's upset us a lot. We've tried. It's because we put them out ourselves on our own label, Seed, so that we don't have, you know, a bigger organization kind of promoting us. There's a lot of different reasons why we decided to do things ourselves. I think that I very much wanted to be in control. You know, you give things up and it's much harder to get things out. The whole music industry has gone through dramatic changes, going to CDs just to begin with, and the collapse of the majors, really. It's just a very different scene. There's so many more people putting out records. We would like to have better distribution, and we were hoping that from this record being more known, we can get our old records in stock. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
And then and talking about the new album is out now. It's called 168K. It's your first in 7 years.
That's really had to do with poverty and things that happened. Again, putting out our own records. We have a lot of material. We could have put out records every year in terms of the material. It has to do really with the logistics of putting records out. We took a bit of a sabbatical from Dial for a couple of years. But essentially, it really is just plainly money, not having enough money and doing it ourselves. We could have had more. You know, we've been playing. We had a couple of years off, but we've been making things up, and we have lots and lots of material, so we could put out other records.
So we can expect a lot of these things appearing.
Yes.
Is 168K much different from Distance Runner?
I look at Distance Runner as it's sort of like a road movie. It was a lot of the bulk of it is live from a series of gigs, a tour primarily that we did in France in 1998. This record, 168K, is more an album in the traditional sense.
How do you write the songs together with your bandmates or lyrics first and then music or other way around?
We improvise and in a sense solidify. I mean, there are different ways of doing things. Some songs, like in fact, Soda Wars was basically hardly done. That's almost an improvisation. We did that maybe once or twice before. We actually did record that in a studio. I have words and we just play together and we essentially just improvise and I sing. Perhaps the words are in front of me. Sometimes I make up the words on the spot and it is just made up. But something like Hi-Fi was a song that was done over time and was more matured, let's say, as was White Lie. But White Lie was essentially made up by Rob and me. Again, perhaps someone just starts playing and the other person just responds and I have the words and we just formulate the song right then and there. And something like Psychotrance was really almost a production number by Rob. He set up an extraordinary drum machine thing and guitar and was playing them together and we sent them back through an amp and so made another compression and I sang over it and I believe I played guitar along with it this time. I'm not even sure, but that happened that way. It's sort of a combination of a production and spontaneous singing over it. I had some words. I had never sung that before. It was automatic. Something like Hey Condition was completely improvised from start to finish. We just started playing. So it varies on things we do. Jungle on our first record was an improvisation. So a lot of our songs are that they all are improvised, but there's different stages at when they are recorded. Sometimes they're recorded after they've been played many times. Sometimes they're recorded the very first time we ever played them. It varies. So some things are worked up more from memory, but they still have, like in Ut songs, often we had a frame, but we would improvise in between within that frame. Very much both in Ut and Dial, and this was very much where we came from in New York, we're using kind of the instruments or the frames of rock, but we're using the ethos of free jazz and the improvisation and sort of the interaction that happens between and then going off, kind of the intersection of free jazz and rock are very much in Ut, in Dial, and to some extent in the whole kind of No Wave New York thing.
I'm I really like the combination between noise rock. A lot of people make noise rock these days. The combination between that and the early 80s no wave feel from the lyrics.
It's hard to delineate myself out of my whole whatever, but very, I mean, I grew up very much under the influence, I guess, of blues singing and, well, I mean, there's millions of, and soul singing. I mean, the great singers like Al Green and James Brown and Billie Holiday, but, you know, all the Lou Reed, the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed singing in Sister Ray, or, you know, the whole Banana album. That's very much where I'm coming from. It's not copying. It is kind of the same aesthetic. Some extraordinary singing of Patti Smith. The thing with Patti Smith, which is another thing with Sally and myself from Utt, we had gotten turned on to Rimbaud, the poet, in high school, and Coltrane at really the same point, which kind of like was like this wonderful expansion of our minds. And we actually learned about Patti Smith because she was a poet who was into Rimbaud, and this is before she made her record. So we were already kind of very hip on the same wavelength that she was on. And so when she made her record, Horses, we were like, wow, this is fantastic. Even at the time, we felt, as we were the next generation reacting again, she was a little too reverent to us, a little too reverent about the whole rock and roll myth, the whole hierarchies of, like, you know, the rock gods, which we were very much were against, and yet she did some fantastic things.
And Lydia Lunch, of course.
Lydia was one of the people at the same time as us, but in truth, we were not that influenced by Lydia. I mean, Lydia had a very kind of theatrical persona that was very much part of her. It was almost like performance art. Let's say we were very similar in our intent to shake up and to confront, but we were not similar in terms of she very much had this kind of theatrical persona, and we very much were being more with our toe theater of cruelty, whereas the thing is like you are in it.
Yeah.
Soda Wars hoorde je. En dat is afkomstig van 168 Kayeners, de nieuwe CD van Dial. En die verschijnt op Seed Records, is een eigen label.